Breaking news, Joe Biden is 79 years old. Plus, does the press get Ron DeSantis? And is it okay for Eric Greitens to go rhino hunting? We'll discuss all this and more on this edition of The Editors. I'm Rich Lowry, and I'm joined as always by the Right Honorable Charles C.W. Cook, Alexander Zan DeSantis, and the Sage of Authenticity Woods, Jim Garrity. You are, of course, listening to a National Review podcast. Our sponsors this episode are Tommy John and ExpressVPN. More about them in due course. If for some reason you're not already following us on a streaming service out there, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. And if you like what you hear here, please consider giving us a glowing five-star review on iTunes. If you don't like what you hear here, please forget I said anything. So, Jim Garrity, we got another pathetic spectacle with Joe Biden falling off of his bike when he was stopped to talk to some well-wishers on vacation in Delaware. I was disturbed by this. I think an old person beginning to get balance problems is a very bad sign. I have a friend, though, who's a bike fanatic, who assured me, look, I can tell you it was the toe thing that his foot was in. It can do it to all of us. Don't read too much into this. But obviously, it's not good for presidents to fall down. It's not good for presidents to, you know, try to go out the wrong door. It's not good for presidents to throw up, as George H.W. Bush did in a state dinner in Japan. All these things will be used against you. You'll be mocked for them, et cetera, et cetera. And there could be more going on here. And you wrote about this in The Jolt the other day and had a disturbingly apt description of what you think we might be reading in a Bob Woodward book in several years about how everyone knew Joe Biden wasn't right, but they were covering it up.
Rich, I will point out, I'm not that worried about the, you know, Biden falling off a bicycle at all. As a citizen of the United States, I need Biden to be minimally competent at his duties in office. I don't need him to do the Tour de France. I don't care if he's bad on his bicycle. I worry much more about his judgment, his memory, his ability to make good decisions and things like that. And that, I think, evidence has been building for a long time that something is wrong with the president. That was the conclusion of a piece I wrote at the kind of, you know, after the worst days of the Afghanistan crisis, where Biden was not in office, you know, was not seen in public for 4 or 5 days. He gave two brief statements over the next couple of days. And when he finally did the sit-down interview with George Stephanopoulos, he has that odd, erratic, that was 4 or 5 days ago, man, you know, outburst there. And it just seemed like this was not a guy who was thinking clearly or thinking coherently, capable of taking hard questions about an emerging, ongoing foreign policy crisis, et cetera. And nothing has happened much since then. And I kind of laid it out at length. We all have eyes. We all have ears. We can see that Joe Biden rarely does more than one public event per day. He very rarely does events at night. When he, you know, almost every weekend, he's back at Rehoboth Beach in Delaware. And lately, he's leaving early, you know, 10 or 11 on Friday morning. We're taping this on a Tuesday, and Biden will have his first public event since then at 2:30 this afternoon. So his weekends are really stretching into like 4 or 5 days. We can see this. We can see that he went 4 or 5 months without doing a sit-down interview. And when he did Jimmy Kimmel. And when he did the interview, he started ranting about interracial couples on television. We can hear the word salad coming out of
him. Yeah, he didn't mean to rant. He meant to say it's a great thing that we see interracial
couples. Yeah, he's not anti it. He was trying to say, isn't this great? Yeah. But he's so incoherent, it's very hard to tell what point he's trying to make there. I think for a long time, people have seen the signs of, you can call it dementia, you can call it aging, Alzheimer's. He's just an old guy. He turns 80 shortly after the election. There's a reason most octogenarians are not working 40-hour work weeks. Never mind the 50, 60, and, you know, long work weeks that we'd assume the president of the United States has got to put in there. And so I think it's just transparently obvious. And I think it's been, people have known this for quite some time, probably back during the presidential campaign. And I think everybody around Biden thought, well, we can fool him. We can get him through this. Don't worry. And so the idea, I wrote up what I envisioned, a Bob Woodward or our old colleague Bob Costa writing some sort of insider thing. Behind the scenes, Ron Klain and Susan Rice and Jill Biden were deeply concerned about the president's health, but felt the public could not stand, you know, that kind of, I don't know for certain that's going to happen, but it is the most believable, quote unquote, bombshell that would not be a bombshell in any way, shape, or form. I think we can all tell Biden is aging before our eyes and increasingly less and less capable of doing his job. But anyway, the other odd thing, and I'll hop off this because I know we got other stuff we got to get to, but isn't it amazing that in the last week or two, it suddenly became okay to talk about this? Whereas if you mentioned this back during Afghanistan, I think it was Chris Saliza who said I was being so mean to Biden and it was so out of line. And it was
all never forget, Jim. Never forget.
Oh, yeah, Irish Alzheimer's. I forget everything but a grudge.
So just to be clear, it's the physical stuff doesn't bother me per se. You know, I wouldn't care if a president's clumsy or whatever. You know, they made Gerald Ford out to be clumsy, even though he's a great athlete. But I think the physical stuff is a manifestation of the things that you're saying, Jim, are, you know, more important, obviously. Memory, acuity. And Zan, I wrote a column yesterday about Biden trying to, you know, now saying that the recession isn't inevitable and just how wrong he's been about everything related to the economy. And I cited the famous malarkey thing from the 2012 debate with Paul Ryan. I just want to make sure, you know, he did say malarkey, right? I'm just double checking out of paranoia. So I went to a clip and watched some of that debate. And you know, Ryan is incredibly young. And Biden, you know, he was not a spring chicken then. And he wasn't, you know, wasn't highly cogent anything he was saying, but he was forceful. There was just a feisty forcefulness. Yeah, feisty, forceful. That's just gone now. And you can see, you know, glimmers of it, echoes of it, but it's not the same.
Yeah, I don't think Biden has ever been known for being an extremely articulate or, you know, kind of bright sounding politician. I know people like him, as I've said many times on this podcast, I never have, don't think I ever will, but I could see why people liked him as a politician. He's just never been a super articulate guy. He's always been kind of, you know, he speaks in a different sort of like folksy way. That's kind of his style, right? And so that's one thing. Like you mentioned, 2012, he was still kind of talking like that. But these days, that's not what he sounds like. He sounds like he has no idea what's going on. And the bike fall, I guess I am willing to believe his toe got stuck in the clip or whatever, and that's why he fell. But I was less concerned by the fact that he fell than with the way he looked trying to get up. Like he's just an old guy, right? And that doesn't mean he necessarily is losing his mind and has dementia, but he's old and it shows, and that's a problem. And like Jim said, I think this was clear during the campaign. I saw Biden speak in person shortly before COVID started, and he just looked bad. He forgot how the number of granddaughters he had. He forgot whether one was in law school or undergrad. Like, just, he's an old guy. He was old then. And if there was something wrong with him then, I think it will come out. And it's going to be obvious that everybody around him knew that he was not fit to be president, and they didn't care. They covered it up. They helped hide it because they didn't want Trump to be president anymore. They thought Biden was the best shot, or maybe they, you know, thought they were close to Biden, like Jim said, and you know, wanted to be in proximity to the president. And they let all of that outweigh the fact that they most likely knew Biden was not going to be successful as the president for 4 years.
So, Charlie, what's your reading on the sudden spate of press coverage about this now? Because sometimes the press will ignore something, and there's a precipitating event, you know, I don't know, there's a new Hunter Biden revelation, all of a sudden you get the Hunter Biden stories or whatever. But it doesn't seem as though anything in particular has happened, except for this is a failing president who's obviously not up for it, that's caused the media to go from considering it a bit of a taboo. My friend Byron York over the Examiner, the entirety of the campaign in 20 is Biden's too old, Biden's too old. And people are tweeting like, you're so mean, how can you possibly say that? He was right, but for whatever reason, the break that was applied here is now off and people are writing about it.
If you take any political incident in isolation, you can, if you want to, make the criticism that it yields look ridiculous. Jimmy Carter being chased by the rabbit, in and of itself, why on earth would you hold that against the guy? But of course, it fed into a pre-existing conception of Carter that by the time it had happened, had crystallized. And I think the Biden bike incident may be the same. It's not that Biden falling off his bike is in and of itself the world's biggest story. It's not even that it's Biden's fault or indicative of a character failing. But taken in context, it reminds us of an underlying truth of which it is a symptom, and that is that Joe Biden is old. And I think what you have seen in the last few days is the cumulative effect of all that has happened over the last year come to fruition. And after a while, it becomes impossible for the press to downplay. In concert, we have seen another cumulative effect, and that is Joe Biden's precipitous decline in the polls. Perhaps early on, you look at the drop and you say it's COVID, or it's inflation, or it's what happened in Afghanistan, or it's the failure of Build Back Better, or it's Republicans being mean to him. But I think now it has become clear that Biden is unpopular, that he's incompetent, and that he's probably not going to recover politically. And what that has done is led those who are on Joe Biden's side politically to start grumbling, and more specifically, to start grumbling to journalists, which has given them permission to repeat the criticisms without feeling disloyal or that they are somehow laundering Republican attacks. And we saw this most obviously in the form of the New York Times piece from a couple of weeks ago that noted that there are many who share Joe Biden's political aims who think that he is the wrong vehicle for it. There was a piece in The Atlantic by Mark Leibovich that said bluntly, he's too old. You can't dismiss that as the machinations of a Mitch McConnell or a Donald Trump or a Ron DeSantis. And I think the press has finally recognized that. So to me, the shift that we've seen is not the product of one incident, the falling off the bike, falling over on the stairs, forgetting where he was or who Barack Obama is. It was the net effect of the last year and a half.
So a special triple barrel exit question for you, Jim Garrity. Eric Greitens would like this triple barreled exit question. First, will Joe Biden serve out his term? If Joe Biden does not serve out his term, will Kamala Harris be the Democratic nominee in 2024? And finally, if Joe Biden does serve out his term but chooses not to run again in 2024, will Kamala Harris be the nominee?
Yes, yes, and yes.
So he'll serve out his term.
Yes.
If he doesn't serve out his term, Kamala Harris will be the nominee.
Yeah.
And if he doesn't run, just serves out his term and doesn't run, Kamala Harris will be the nominee.
Yeah.
So we got, yeah, got Biden serving out his term and Kamala Harris is a lock, basically. That's your answer.
Yeah.
Zan?
So I do think he'll serve out his term. If he didn't, I think Harris would be, well, it's hard to say more or less likely, but I think in neither case will she be the nominee, whether regardless of whether he serves out his term or not. I don't think she'll be the Democratic nominee.
Shall I cook?
I think that Joe Biden will serve out his term. I don't think that he will be the nominee in 2024, and I don't think that Kamala Harris will either.
So I do not wish him ill in any way. I hope he serves out his term. I think it would be good for the country if he serves out his term, but I think the answers are no, yes, no. With that, let's hear from our first sponsor of this episode, Tommy John. Is the summer heat melting your ice cubes? Stay frosty where it counts in brand new Tommy John underwear. Because you wear Tommy John, you're that much cooler, so you can do everything better thanks to breathable, lightweight fabric with four times the stretch of competing brands. With dozens of comfort innovations, Tommy John will keep you looking and feeling cool all season long, from lounging at home to summertime fun. That's why Tommy John doesn't have customers. They have fanatics. With over 17 million pairs sold, people love their Tommy John underwear and loungewear. And Tommy John doesn't just make you feel cooler, you actually are cooler. Stay up to 7 degrees cooler than cotton in Tommy John's Apollo underwear. Plus, there's no risk because you're covered with Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear, or it's free guarantee. Shop TommyJohn.com/editors right now for 20% off your first order. Get 20% off right now at TommyJohn.com/editors. That's Tommy John. TommyJohn.com/editors. Please check it out and see the site for details. So, Charlie, we have an extensive New Yorker profile by Dexter Filkins, very accomplished journalist, did great work for the New York Times over in Iraq during the Iraq War. And this is, you know, part of the ongoing DeSantis buzz and the buzz about a potential DeSantis-Trump clash in 24. What do you make of the piece?
I thought overall it was quite good. There were some parts of it that I disagreed with, but I didn't think it was malicious or ignorant. Some of it relied heavily upon one's priors. For example, DeSantis is commonly cast in the piece as some extremist libertarian, which I don't think he is. And in fact, many of my criticisms of DeSantis are from the other direction, that he has been too happy to wield state power or to intervene in the market. There was also a tendency to repeat views stated by others that were off the mark. For example, DeSantis is criticized in it for not having introduced monoclonal antibody therapies quickly enough, which is funny because if you go back to that whole debate, the first criticism of DeSantis was that he had introduced monoclonal antibody treatments and shouldn't have because they didn't work. And then it was that he had introduced them and, okay, they did work, but it was an obvious distraction from the vaccine, which was being driven by Fox News. And then it was, well, they really worked very well and Florida was being selfish in keeping them. And DeSantis was depriving the citizens of other states from using them. And now it's that he didn't do it earlier. I mean, okay. And there was an absurd quote in there from Stuart Stevens saying that DeSantis's approach has obviously been to turn out the white rump that is the Republican Party, to anger white voters. And then you don't have to worry about winning anyone else. This is false. This is annoying. For a start, if you look at DeSantis's behavior prior to COVID, he had extremely high approval ratings across the board because he did all sorts of things Republicans don't usually do, including a great deal of environmental legislation, which he's continued. And if you look at his outreach at the moment, I mean, he is determined to win a majority of Hispanics and probably will. Certainly a majority of Cubans, Venezuelans, Colombians. So this is just a reflexive silliness that you find in any piece about any Republican, including, it seems, those who were born in Mexico. But I thought otherwise it was fair. You know, even the harsh criticisms that it included, I think, had an element of truth about them. If you talk to people about Governor DeSantis, you will learn that he is introverted, that he doesn't talk to many advisors, that he is much more likely to seek the counsel of, say, his wife, that he doesn't have time for people in general, and especially those who can't help him. You know, that he's really smart, but that he's not particularly interested in applying that outside of achieving his aims. I mean, these were cast in some sense as criticisms in the piece, and you know, maybe they are, but they also seem to be true. So, you know, I thought it was fair. On balance, it made me think that it's more likely rather than less that he's going
to
run.
So, Zan, one thing I was glad to see in this piece, and I was completely convinced of since I wrote this piece on DeSantis's COVID response back in whatever it was, May 2020, is this is a guy who studies. And he when I talked to him, I mean, he knew all the research. He obviously was extremely well-informed, but there was this image of him as this ridiculous bumpkin who was just, you know, doing what he heard on Fox News rather than taking a really deliberate approach that not everyone agreed with, you know, and it's going to various elements of how we responded to COVID will be argued about for all time. But this was these were very, very well-informed choices.
They absolutely were. And I think in hindsight, kind of like a lot of what happened with COVID, looking back, some decisions were smart and played out well and others didn't, but some were, you know, a fair bet to make, let's say, or an informed choice and a kind of a safe attempt given how little we knew at the beginning. And it's easy to forget with how quickly our news cycles go and how many crazy things seem to be happening these days that, you know, the media and Democrats spent a good chunk of the pandemic, if not most of kind of the heart of the actual pandemic unfolding, looking for Republicans to criticize. And Ron DeSantis was their number one hate figure besides Trump. And once Trump was gone out of office, they focused in on DeSantis. And the claim was, you know, everything he's done is going to make people in Florida die at higher rates. And that actually did not end up being the case. Yet they spent months and months and months acting like this was a pandemic of red states. And, you know, Charlie wrote a really good piece rebutting that claim. This was not about politics for the most part. This was not about what, you know, the policies people chose to put in place, although some ended up being smarter than others. But it's an example of how early on they were scared of DeSantis. I think they were right to be. He's obviously a very good politician. I don't agree with everything that he's done policy-wise, but he does know his stuff. And I think he's making a pretty serious effort to craft policies that are good ones, you know, with COVID or otherwise. And I think they hate that about him. He's good at handling the media, rebutting the media, kind of like Trump, but he's better at it, honestly. And I think he's a much better politician.
Jim? I want to observe that we know somewhere on Twitter, someone is going to rant. Well, of course, Alexander would be praising the Florida governor. She's related to him. DeSantis, spelling matters. So I think, one, the New Yorker profile is a very interesting indicator of kind of a shift in the center of gravity in Republican politics. No one should have any illusions. Donald Trump is still, at this day, probably the most likely person to be the Republican nominee. He still has huge advantages in terms of name ID and, I guess, kind of a, I think, an instinctive and reflexive support of a lot of people who will vote in a Republican primary. But I think the ground is shifting, and I do think things like the pandemic and the Biden administration, how it's approaching the governance and every issue facing the country, is shifting the focus of the average Republican. And Donald Trump, pretty much since he's left office, has just been mono-focused, mono-obsessed on the 2020 election and how it was stolen and how it was all the work of Venezuelan hackers and how there was bamboo in the ballot paper in Arizona and all these nutty, crazy conspiracy theories. And it just seems out of time, out of touch. I mentioned that at the NRA convention in Houston, there were empty seats in a not terribly big hall when Donald Trump was giving his speech. Now, you know, at people at the NRA convention, if you go every year, you've had the opportunity to hear President Trump speak for several years. So maybe he's not the draw he used to be. But I just kind of, you know, Donald Trump has been running this three-ring circus of the political world since, you know, early 2015. That's like, you know, 7 years ago. It's going to be 9 years ago by the time the presidential campaign begins in earnest. I kind of think the average Republican might be interested in something new, might want something, you know, might feel like, okay, that was great, but now we need something that's responsive to today's issues. And I think DeSantis, primarily because of the pandemic, but on a whole bunch of issues, has done a really good job of positioning himself as the natural heir apparent to the Trump era in the Republican Party. Doesn't mean, you know, is he a lock? No. But I think just inevitably, it's very tough to be front and center in American politics for long stretches. Reagan utterly dominated our politics and, you know, obviously because of Alzheimer's and other issues, he departed the stage. It's very rare to see a former president remain front and center this way. So I do think this is a sign that there's a you know, gathering of momentum around DeSantis that is not to be ignored. Obviously, you're going to see a lot of hit pieces. Obviously, you're going to hear a lot of, you know, Democrats and Democrat-aligned media try to paint the DeSantis era in Florida as this, you know, long, nightmarish hellscape. But obviously, people keep moving there. Obviously, a lot of people who are there are pretty happy with him. And there's a good chance he's going to win re-election, probably by a pretty healthy margin. And people are going to look at this and say, huh, maybe this is the, you know, the natural next step in Republican governance. And I think, you know, DeSantis could be the kind of guy who can appeal to a lot of Trump voters and be much more palatable to the folks, you know, the never Trump Republicans who looked at Trump and just said, that's utterly unacceptable. It violates my morals, principles, my belief in the Constitution, et cetera.
So, Charlie, next question to you. Percentage odds that Ron DeSantis will be the Republican nominee in 2024. You got to factor everything in. Will Trump run? If Trump does run, will DeSantis run, et cetera, et cetera, and come out with your percentage odds?
I now think it's 50-50. I've said before that I think Trump is declining in the estimations of Republican voters, including primary voters. I think that is true. I think it is more true as the days go by. And although I try to temper this conception, because I do live in Florida and I'm therefore subject to probably more enthusiasm for DeSantis than you'd find elsewhere, I think I'm right.
50%, Jim Garrity.
Maybe it's my distance from Florida, but I'm not too far behind Charlie. I'd say about 40% and rising.
All right. So we got the Florida answer, which is 50. The distant from Florida answer, which is 40. Zan.
Well, here's the maybe related to Ron DeSantis answer. I'd say 60%.
60?
Yeah.
Just because you want to live in the White House.
Just because you're related to him, Alexandra.
I honestly might be. I mean, I have a different last name, but he's probably an Americanized version of the same name. So we may be distantly related somewhere back in Italy. But in any event, I think the kind of combination of the possibility that Trump might not run at all, the possibility that he'll run and not do well enough, the possibility that DeSantis will just keep on rising combined, I'll say 60%.
Wow. So I'm way down. I'm like 20 or maybe 25. I just think, you know, the odds still are that Trump runs. And I still think in that circumstance, DeSantis would not run. So if he doesn't run, it's zero. And if Trump does run, you know, it's not going to be easy. Trump doesn't run, there's still going to be a lot of people in there and it's not going to be a lock. So I'm down 20% or so, which is much more, much greater odds than I would give anyone else who's not Trump to be the Republican nominee in 24. With that, let's go to Charlie to hear from our second sponsor this episode.
Which is ExpressVPN, which is a product that I use myself all the time, because using the internet without ExpressVPN is like leaving your laptop exposed at the coffee shop table, or perhaps at the beach bar table, while you run out to the bathroom. Most of the time, you're probably fine, but what if one day you come out of the bathroom and your laptop is gone? You probably wonder, why do you need a VPN? What does all of that mean? Well, a VPN essentially creates a tunnel through which your computer connects to the internet. And this means that even if you're connected to an unencrypted network at a cafe or hotel, airport or a beach bar, a hacker on that network can gain access to your personal data, your passwords, your financial details, etc. And it really doesn't take too much technical knowledge to hack someone. You just need some cheap hardware and a 12-year-old could do it, which is a problem because your data is valuable. Hackers can make up to $1,000 per person selling personal information on the dark web. But if you use ExpressVPN, then your computer is not accessing the internet directly through the network you're on, but through that encrypted tunnel. Which creates a conduit between your device and the internet so hackers can't steal your sensitive data. ExpressVPN is particularly secure. It would take a hacker with a supercomputer over a billion years to get past ExpressVPN's encryption. Most of them don't have that long. It's easy to use. You just fire up the app. You click one button to get protected. It takes care of all of the details. And it works on all devices, phones, laptops, tablets, and more, so you can stay secure on the go. As I say, I use this all the time, especially when I'm traveling in hotel rooms or cafes, and I am full in the knowledge that I'm not likely to have my identity stolen. So if you, too, want to protect yourself and create a tunnel between your laptop or phone and the internet, all you need to do is visit expressvpn.com/editors. That's expressvpn.com/editors. And if you do, you'll get an extra 3 months of the service for free at expressvpn.com/editors.
So, Zan, we have a controversy last couple of days. This Eric Greitens ad seeking to be the Republican Senate nominee in Missouri. I had not watched it yet. I watched it just prior to beginning to record here, and my reaction is, okay, he's going to be the nominee, unfortunately. So it's an ad where he says he's going to go rhino hunting. He's walking down a sidewalk. He has a shotgun. He's joined by these guys. I don't know, they look like a Navy SEAL team. They're breaking into some suburban house where I guess a rhino lives. And he says, you know, there's no limit on how many you're going to bag. And the MAGA team has to go out and hunt down these rhinos. There's, of course, been an explosion of attention and criticism of the ad, which is exactly what Greitens intended. What do you make of it?
Well, I think it's a really silly ad. And for my money, it's just indicative of a crowded primary race in Missouri. The primary election's not for about, you know, more than a month still. And there's a lot of high profile Missouri candidates. There's at least three Republicans that I think have a decent shot. I don't know how much polling there's been. I haven't looked at any of the recent data, if there is any, but Greitens, you know, fell a long way from the governorship a few years ago. He's now facing off against the current attorney general, who's fairly popular, fairly successful, a sitting Congresswoman, Vicky Hartzler, has some big endorsements, including from Josh Hawley. I think he's trying to distinguish himself in what seems to be a pretty crowded field. I think it's a dumb way to do it. It probably will be at least somewhat successful. This kind of thing works. And, you know, voters who might not have been paying much attention to him might be now, especially now that he's been, you know, so-called canceled by social media companies over this. But I don't think it's really indicative of him being a very serious candidate or one that's distinguishing himself in any way I'd want to support.
So, Charlie, you're a gun guy and a guy who makes wide latitude for political speech and martial metaphors and all that. Where are you on this ad?
Well, I didn't like it at all. I will certainly maintain my policy of wide latitude in that I don't think that what Greitens said is incitement or is a threat. I don't think it's illegal. And I wouldn't want him to be blamed for anyone who saw it and got the wrong idea. But I don't like it. I don't like the implication, rhino hunting. Yes, we use martial language in politics all the time because politics is a replacement for war. That's why we talk about, you know, targets, campaigns. But this crosses a line because he ranges into the details of hunting. You can bag as many as you like. It's not a nice way to talk about one's political opponents. And I think it's confusing. You say I'm a gun guy for gun guys, in that the image that he portrays is of a man running for office, in other words, seeking a position within the government, who calls himself a Navy SEAL. He's actually a former Navy SEAL. I don't think he's actually allowed to call himself that anymore. Using the power of the government in a no-knock raid on a private house, which is not a big thing for gun guys, I don't have to tell you. That's not a libertarian image. If you compare it, for example, to Joe Manchin shooting the cap and trade bill, that made sense. He was saying, okay, I'm running for office, but what I want to do is end this program, kill this proposal, stop this law. What exactly was Eric Greitens saying, that he's going to hunt people who disagree with him and knock down the door with the cops? So I don't like this in any sense, and I was predisposed to dislike it because I don't like Eric Greitens, and for once I agree with Josh Hawley that given Greitens' past, he is ill-suited to run for the Senate, and I hope that the people of Missouri agree and that the other candidates in the race can get together and, grasping that they have a collective action problem, decide which one of them is going to take him on and prevent him from splitting the vote and prevailing.
Jim Garrity, exit question to you. So we have Greitens, who would presumably be the weakest of the general election possibilities in that primary. You have Dr. Oz, who won narrowly in Pennsylvania and had a disturbingly narrow general election. poll result. We have Herschel Walker. I think it's up to three secret children. Is it three secret children? I'm not sure. So next question to you. And when it comes to the battle for the Senate, Republicans are blowing it. Republicans are rocking it, or something in between.
The short answer is they're coming close to blowing it. But on the issue of Greitens, I know you want to wrap up fast, but I just want to get, hey guys, remember when Greitens' hairdresser testified that he was aggressive with her during a forced sexual encounter, and tied her up in a basement and handcuffed, blindfolded her, and used a partially nude photo to blackmail her? Hey, remember the good old days when that was a career killer? This man is a sociopath. You know, he doesn't belong in the Senate. He doesn't belong walking the streets. He's a maniac. And also, it kind of emphasized and underlined what Charlie said. Notice there was no, I oppose with rhinos because X. There's just a vague reference to corruption and, you know, cowardice and all that stuff. The Greitens ad is this malevolent, aggressive id. Wouldn't it be great if we could hunt down and kill people who politically annoy us? There is something, not there's more than a little bit of fascism in this vibe, this ad. This, oh, wouldn't it be great if we could be violent? Wouldn't it be great if we could kill people who we disagree with? This is probably the most malevolent ad. I look at this and I'm like, well, either Missouri has to reject this guy, or I lose faith in whether Missouri Republicans should be picking candidates. Because there's nothing about, he's not making a policy argument. He's not offering a plan for it. He's basically saying, wouldn't it be great to kill people? And remember me, I'm the guy who kidnapped and forcibly sexually assaulted a woman. This guy belongs nowhere near the U.S. Senate. This guy belongs nowhere. I wouldn't, you know, this guy, literally the guy shouldn't be elected dog catcher. Anyway, as for Oz, he's clearly the Ford Pinto of president of Senate candidates. Everybody could see that this guy was a disaster, that he gave you almost all of the MAGA weaknesses with none of the MAGA advantages. And look, here we are. He is, you know, now 9 points behind to a guy who's still suffering from a stroke and who hasn't been on the campaign trail in more than a month. Herschel Walker, look, I want to like this guy, but not only is he a bad candidate when it comes to articulating basic facts about why he believes what he believes, he's not getting any better. And there's no sign of him making any effort to get better at this. I guess he's just counting on being Herschel Walker being enough. Republicans are not quite totally blowing it, but they're getting close to it. And there's nobody for Republicans to blame but their own primary voters.
So not blowing it, but close. Zan.
I'd say somewhere in between, but or maybe blowing it. I don't know. I think their advantage is so big that it'd be really tough to actually blow the advantage, but they could definitely have fielded a slate of much better candidates and be sitting much more comfortably.
Charlie Cook.
I think they're half blowing it because they will blow some races as a result of this. And then, of course, even if they win because of the national environment, they will have to live with these candidates for 6 years. It's interesting that, you know, we pay so much attention to the presidency, but the Senate candidates serve for longer, 150% of a presidential term, and yet we seem to care very little at the moment about who we nominate.
So they're closer to blowing it than to rocking it, but still it's so hard to blow it in this environment. They're making some poor choices that are going to cost them, but still the overall environment is going to save them and get some of these weak candidates over the finish line. With that, let's hit a few other things before we go. Jim Garrity, you made your accustomed jaunt to Hilton Head.
Yep. Have family right around there. And, you know, good to get away for a week. I think one of my favorite discoveries was Burnt Church Distillery. And this is the name of the road that it's on. It's not that they get together and burn churches or anything like that. But fine facility, good food, good things to drink. Just a wonderful night out when it was much needed.
And Zan, you made a visit to San Diego.
I did. My husband's family lives out there, and we went out there for a family event just for a couple of days, quick turnaround because we had a wedding here in Virginia. So couldn't stay very long, but I never fail to be shocked by how beautiful California is. And I just wish it were a better state because it has a lot going for it.
San Diego is so awesome. If I could live anywhere in the country, and no disrespect to any of the burgs you visited, which are totally fine. Fine places with wonderful people, but San Diego is just amazing. Charlie Cook, your kids have been swimming.
Yes, well, it's how they're swimming. Obviously, my kids can swim. They're Florida kids, but just watching the development of their swimming over the last few years, you know, there was a time when they didn't like going under the water, even in the swimming pool. And the other day at the beach, I mean, you'd think they were fish. They were just jumping into these big waves that were coming at them. You know, they were sort of diving at the ground, rolling around in the sand under the water. And yes, it makes me a little nervous occasionally, and I was standing pretty close to them, but it's just fascinating how quickly kids who live on the beach become water babies. And I guess that's a real blessing of living where we do.
So I went to a beginner's tennis clinic the other day. I desperately need more exercise. I love competitive sports, and we're playing kind of these four guys who aren't very good at tennis. We're playing these little games against one another. It was a heck of a lot of fun, but I have to say, I still believe that two of the most ridiculous words in the English language are tennis whites. So with that, it's time for our editor's picks. Jim Garrity, what's your pick?
A lot of strong contenders, but I'm going to go with my colleague, Charlie Cook's recent corner post. Fletcher's mother is a freak. Very rarely can you be hard. In a lot of other writers, this would have come across as harsh. And Charlie knows how to hit just the right note to really rip into someone for making a decision that is ultimately harmful for their children without coming up as mean-spirited or gratuitous or anything like that. Charlie writes about this with anger, but also with love. He talks about his kids on this podcast all the time, and it really shines through in this corner post. Once again, well done, Charlie.
Zan, what's your pick?
My pick is a reported piece from John McCormick last week. It's called Three GOP Senators Propose a Family-Friendly Tax Reform. And it's a kind of close look at a new kind of a revamped version of a family policy plan, kind of looking forward to if there's a post-Roe America very soon, what a pro-family policy might look like. I don't know that I agree really with every aspect of the plan, but it's certainly worth understanding and taking a look at for the debates ahead.
Charlie.
Mine is a magazine piece by Christine Rosen titled Ban Kids from Social Media. And I'm not entirely sure that I agree, at least not yet, because I need to think more about what Christine Rosen has written. But this is a really interesting area, and it's a question that hasn't come up in human history for obvious reasons. And as such, it's difficult to apply any priors or pre-existing ideological habits to the matter. And I think what Christine Rosen has written is fascinating and provocative and worthy of consideration.
So that's the third time that piece has been picked. That might be a record for any National Review.
Well, I hadn't read it last time. I read it this morning.
I have to notify Christine. So my pick is another Kyle Smith piece. I think I picked one last week as well. America is craving a reset about the Top Gun sequel. And he makes the point that it's not that, as some conservatives said, that this is an anti-woke movie. It's just a non-woke movie. And this is a piece that is just an excellent example of cultural analysis and really insightful about this movie and the moment we're in. So that's it for us. You've been listening to a National Review podcast. Any rebroadcast, retransmission, or account of this game without the express written permission of National Review Magazine is strictly prohibited. Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Zan. Thanks to Tommy John and ExpressVPN. And thanks especially to all of you for listening. We're the editors. We'll see you next time.